Hey, gals, ghouls, and baddest days of the world. I am your co-host, Cass Clark, and I'm back with our lovely co-host, Ryan C. Bradley.
Hello.
And today we have a special guest, horror writer Scott Alderberg. Would you like to introduce yourself for a little bit to our guests?
Sure. I'm glad to do this. Thank you for having me. Quick introduction. I guess I live in Brooklyn and I have a recently published novel, The Screaming Child with Max Booth and Ghoulish Books. And it's we can talk about it a little bit. It's basically a missing child, a mother grieving missing child story with elements of mystery and horror. Two of my favorite genres for sure. They long have been. And since we are going to talk about films, they should. I'm a, you know, like you guys, I'm sure big film nut, horror for sure, mystery. And every summer for many, about 12, 13 years now in New York City, I host thing in Bryant Park, which is an outdoor park behind the Brooklyn Public the New York City Public Library, the one with the two lions. People probably would know from movies and stuff if they don't live in New York.
Wow.
We have a talk about movies every week in the park, and I've been doing that. It's really a lot of fun. Older movies, new movies with guests. Now it's tied to someone who wrote a book. Like last year, for example, we had Nick Davis, who's the grand great grandson of Herman Mankiewicz, the co-writer of Citizen Kane, and
Whoa.
he wrote a book about his Herman and his brother Joe, who are both, and then we talked about the book, their lives. And it could be about any number. We had one talk last year about Godzilla movies. Someone had read a book about them. So it goes all over the place. You know, from Citizen Kane to Godzilla is a pretty big gamut, I would say. So
Very cool.
I'm done, you know, big movie buff for sure.
Yeah. Speaking of mysteries, that's a big theme that we're gonna be talking about today. Mysteries with like a big twist of sorts. And usually we do like a history that like goes through, but this is kind of like a tricky one to do, so we're not doing the history today. But Ryan, did any
Any movie we bring up, because I think a lot of these movies are based on like you think it's natural, you think it's supernatural, and then in the third act you find out it's not. So like because the trope is basically the third act twist, we can't do a history
Right,
without
no, I'm not. I definitely,
it.
no, I agree with that. I'm not into giving away endings. That stinks. I mean,
Oh
I
yeah.
definitely don't want to do that. But I just sort of like the discussion of that fine line, you know, like it goes way back. You know, like a classic example, I guess, which everyone should know. So I don't think we're giving any, would be like the Hound of the Baskervilles, say, right? You know, a lot of the Sherlock Holmes stories are like this. It seems incredibly bizarre. You know, it's not going to be supernatural. It can't, in those, but he sets it up that way with a hound from hell. And then in the end, you know, Sherlock Holmes breaks it all down for us. But that sort of fine line going, you know, all the way back, is it horror? Is it mystery? Is it supernatural, rational? Is it fast? They're fascinating. I mean, when they're well done, of course, but you know,
Absolutely.
when they thread that line. But no, definitely not into, we thought it was this and that. That's no fun. Let people discover the movies if they haven't seen them, of course.
So we're going to be talking about Don't Look Now today, and then also Cure, Kurosawa's masterpiece. So we're definitely going to get into spoiler territory at some point, listeners. So definitely watch these movies if you haven't, so you don't get spoiled for the third
That's point at Kiyoshi Kurosawa, that the other Kurosawa. I was watching it again this, you know, this last night actually, and I was like, wow. You know, that's like, imagine the Yankees came up with a shortstop named Billy Jeter. You know, it'd be like, wow, he's following in the footsteps of not, e it could not have been easy for Kyo. He's a great director himself, totally different than no relation to Akira Kurosawa, you know, but that couldn't have been easy. I was just dawned on me that I was watching it the other day, you know.
It was funny because I was like trying to get my husband to watch it, and I think he will. I think I sold him. I think I did a good elevator pitch. I was like, if you like mysteries and if you like things
Oh
that
yeah.
show like how humans can be under stress, like he loves heat. I was like, oh, it's like heat, but like more edge of your seat. And he's like, okay. I was like, it's also not 3 hours. Like, okay.
I hadn't seen it since it came out, which it was 1997, I guess. You know, it's on Criterion now, so I turned it on the last night. It holds up. It was really good
Oh,
still. I thought
absolutely.
it's creepy, and the actor, he was big at the time. He's a terrific actor. You know,
Oh,
the
yeah.
lead, it's really a good movie. Recommend without reservations for sure.
Lauren, do you want to kick us off with an intro for Don't Look Now?
So our first movie today is Don't Look Now. It was directed by Nicholas Roeg from Daphne du Maurier's short story, which was adapted for the screen by Chris Bryant and frequent Road collaborator Alan Scott. Du Maurier's work is excellent in its own right and was frequently adapted by Alfred Hitchcock, including The Birds, which we covered in our Animal Attack episode. The film stars Donald Sutherland as John Baxter and Julie Christie as Laura Baxter, a couple whose daughter, Christine, dies in a terrible accident in the film's opening. The pair goes to Venice, where John is restoring a church, and they meet a pair of sisters on holiday, Heather played by Hilary Mason and Wendy played by Clelia Mantegna. Heather claims to be psychic and can see their daughter. Julie believes her and John doesn't, which is really the main conflict of the movie. So I'd like to start just asking, like, how y'all like the movie?
I'll say this, you know, I'm clear by far the oldest one here. And I first saw that movie decades ago on commercial, you know, TV with commercials, you know, it's a lot. And I remember now, I was thinking about it the other day, it was at college in the like TV room late at night, CBS. I mean, I knew the movie. I was, you know, big on movies then. I knew of the movie. So there must have been some cuts and they were commercials. And over the years, I've seen it on the big screen. I've seen it on, I have now the Criterion DVD of it. So many, many times over the years, I watched it once on my computer, I remember. Every single time, it's still disorienting and uncanny. It's amazing. It's really one of the, it's really a film that holds up to repeated viewings. I always see something different and new in it. And the way the editing and the mood and the relationship between the character, the married couple, it's one of the best portraits, too, of a marriage of, in any kind Absolutely. Of film. With Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, who are both great at the height of their 70s fame, looks and everything else. I love Nicholas Roeg. He's one of my favorite directors. But that, I mean, Walkabout, too, I love. Performance, which is also a Donald Camel film. But he's never been better. He just peaked. That's when he was in that zone, those first four or five movies he made. And he was making film. It's a film like none other. I mean, it's been imitated many, many times. But when you see it, it's still just, it's a really disorienting, unsettling kind of film. You know, it's not like a gory film, but it gets under your skin in a beautiful way, kind of.
Yeah.
I think.
I'm thinking for TV, they mostly just cut the very end with the throat cutting and the sex.
Probably.
Scene, right?
There's not much else to cut. But I'm thinking like with commercial, I was used to it, I guess. And now I can't stand commercial. Who's going to watch commercial? But I guess I was used, but to think of how that broke up the rhythm of the movie, I guess I just accepted it because it was a normal thing then, you know? Yeah. So no, I don't think there was all that. And you understood, you know, as much as, but the first time I would say too, it's like, it's not like you piece everything together on one viewing. Right. Am I wrong? Yeah. Is that your impression? It's still like, what happened? You really want to see it again after the first viewing, I think.
Yeah, because this was a first viewing for me. Like, I feel like in the past, I don't know what it was. Like, I feel like sometimes this is like one of those films where like you have to be in, at least for me, like in a good, like you have to be in like an open-minded, just like this is like a Saturday afternoon. I'm just going to like go into this journey with this movie kind of a mood. Because I tried to watch it before and I just, for whatever reason, I was like, I'm not into this. But I watched it yesterday and I was captivated. I was just like, and I knew it was a horror. I knew it was gonna, like, something had to happen that was like intriguing because like of the premise, and I knew that there was like some supernatural element to it, but I was just like hooked at like from the jump, just on like the strength of the character's relationship. Like I was really invested in just watching how they're dealing with this loss. And in some ways, I don't know if you've ever seen The Haunting of Julia with I love that movie.
Similar theme, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's very similar. But in that one, it just mostly follows the mother and like the husband kind of out of the picture, basically. But I was really surprised with how much I really liked it. And I agree that I think it's one of those films where after you watch it, it's so unsettling. And it's in another way, we'll talk about later, it does the same thing that Cure does in a way where like there is a straightforward, realistic interpretation for like what happened in the film, but there's also a bunch of just like unexplainable things too that we'll just never know. And I love that quality, right? Like,
I agree,
see a premonition of his own death, like,
The thing that's one of the things that's so like I didn't fully get on the first viewing is Julie Christie's character, his wife, is the one who talks to the clairvoyant woman. There's two sisters that you mentioned, one of whom is blind. I mean, there's so many plays on tropes on vision, not seeing, seeing through the mirrors pop up everywhere. That, you know,
The water.
The water, absolute reflections in the water, right? Things like that in Venice. It takes place in Venice. A very creepy, depopulated, you know, off the beaten track version of Venice. That's partly the mood is great. But she's the one who's like sort of the quote unquote believer, you might say, in extrasensory perception or the supernatural, for lack of a better term. But, you know, after another viewing, so I realized the one who actually has it, it's clear because it's all conveyed visually, is Donald Sutherland. Because he's the one, like in the very beginning, he has a premonition when he sees that little red blot on that go across the, and he runs out. He has, there's nothing rational that makes him run out to think his daughter's in danger because he's not warned.
I was wondering that.
There's nothing. You don't really get all this unless like he ran outside. But you know, he's the one who has a premonition, who has got the clairvoyant, but he's not willing to accept that. Well, he doesn't understand it. He's a rationalist. Clearly, he's a rationalist. But he's the one with the irrational connection to the irrational. But unfortunately for him, he doesn't understand that until maybe it's too late. You know,
one of the questions I've had about the movie every time I watch it, does he believe that he's seeing his daughter at the end through his clairvoyance? Like, has he accepted his ability and that's why he's chasing her? Or is he still in denial?
That's a good question. It's kind of ambiguous. I don't know. I mean, maybe when he actually gets, I mean, not to sound glib, not making a joke, but maybe when he actually gets cut by the killer as he's dying, you know, bleeding, he maybe then he sort of sees like a person drowning. I mean, he kind of sees, that's how I, you know, kind of how I took it. But there's so many eyes because he's the one who keeps saying nothing is as it seems. He says that several times in the film. And I was watching because the other day, like on the Criterion DVD, you know, there were some extras, and one of them was an old interview with Nicholas Rogue, and he inherited the script. Someone else was going to direct it or something, and he took it over. And you know, then he made it his own film, obviously. It's a Nicholas Rogue film through and through. And he said, like, when he looked at the script, he liked it, but he said to the script writer, Alan Scott, I think, because he's talking also, that we need a theme. You know, it's beautiful, it's got all this stuff, it's mysterious. And the theme was nothing is as it seems. You know, because that's sort of how the whole, and he does keep saying that, Donald Sutherland, but he doesn't seem to understand why he doesn't live by what he's, but he really doesn't live by what he says. I don't know. And I think, you know, that partly, you know, when that, remember at the very end, when the killer who's a, you know, a midget or a dwarf really, sort of in this red slick raincoat, cuts him, the killer shakes his head.
Yeah.
And one interpretation I once read, and it kind of is hinted at even in the story, is he's like sort of shaking his head like, you didn't see it. You didn't believe your own, you know, you didn't follow your own instincts. So he's kind of been killed for not trusting in his own perception.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one way of looking at it. That's kind of how I took it after five viewings.
I read the story yesterday and she nods in the story.
She kind of nods, right?
She's nodding in the story and smiling, which is one change. Another, I think, big change between the story and the movie is he's trying to protect the little girl who's being chased in the book, in the short story. And in the movie, there's no one chasing her to protect her from.
Right, that's true. Yeah. No, that was a big... Well, I think another really big... The story is great. I mean...
Absolutely.
You know, not to like go off to that's it was one of the things I read and prepared for, like writing the Screaming Child, since it's a, you know, it's a great grieving parent story, among other things. Yeah. But one thing they changed from the story to the movie is, you remember in the story, the child has died already when the story started of meningitis or something.
Yeah.
So they're two, it starts with them being two grieving parents. That whole beginning in the movie, which is amazing, is that they invented for the movie, and it makes it that much stronger, right? When you see the child die and the way it's done and the editing. But it's funny, if you want to hear, like Donald Sutherland was talking to one of these extras, and he said, or I think it was, no, Nicholas Rogue, he said the child who, you know, the actor who dies in the story was a very, very good swimmer, this little kid in the water and was under the water and was very proficient in the water, and they had people there watching and everything, obviously. And then when he shot the scene, Donald Sutherland came out and he's yelling and screaming and he's horrified. And the child became like terrified. Donald Sutherland like scared the shit out of this poor little kid. It was great in the water, but then he was like, oh my God, I'm drowning. And I was just, Because Donald Sutherland was so, you know, convincing when he, and that's a strong scene when he scoops. That's really a strong scene. You don't have to be a parent, but obviously that's like a parent's worst, you know, worst nightmare. But that was a big change, like showing that. And then they go ahead to the part in Venice when they're trying to recover sort of from what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. The other big change I saw was I think in the movie, there's this symbolic resonance to the work Donald's doing, kind of restoring the church, but also trying to, like, he and Laura are trying to restore themselves.
Yeah,
after
yeah.
the grief. And there's all these conversations about, like, can we ever get the church back to the way it was originally?
Yeah,
I think
that's
the answer
point.
For people grieving and the church is no.
Yeah.
That's also a big addition. I think a very good addition to the film from the story.
Yeah, no, you're right. Making him a restorer was, first, it just adds a lot of atmosphere in Venice. But no, you're right. There's definitely that theme of trying to restore something that, and yeah, the answer really is, you can only get so far, I guess. You can restore something, but, you know. I mean, that's why, you know, it's a very famous scene, you know, the love scene. But that's one of the reasons, you know, that's such a great scene. I mean, at the time, too, it must have been any time, but it must have been really quite, it's an erotic scene. It's beautiful. But it's like such a great scene that, you know, it's one of the rare sex scenes that, you know, it's not about like so many scenes in movie sex scenes or seduction or one person's out to get, you know, trying to get another into bed. This is like one of the best scenes between a married couple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Having like conjugal sex, whatever. And, you know, cutting between that fantastic cutting fast forward when they're getting dressed. And it starts like, watch it again. So normally, like she's in the bathtub and he's doing something very mundane. It's so normal.
Yeah.
That's a great scene. I mean, for that, I mean, obviously it's a classic scene, but that whole aspect of it is just great, I think.
Yeah,
really
I absolutely
is, you know?
Love that scene because I feel like, I mean, on Twitter all the time, there's always like some people being like, oh, there's like too much sex in movies or whatever. It's like, stop. There's not enough sex.
But, yeah, no, right. I know.
But like, in this one, I feel like this is one of those movies where like, if you cut it out, you lose so much because it just shows you like, without ever telling you, without having any like direct conversation, as a viewer, you're like, oh, it's probably been a very long time since they've been able to like have like any intimacy, any closeness, especially at the loss of a child, any passion. This is right after she has that like little epiphany where she's like, I think I'm finally okay with it. You know, he's very much not okay with his daughter's death. She's finally like, I think I'm okay. I'm moving on. She finally is like happy. And even though he doesn't agree or he's not in that same emotional headspace, you see that like a scene earlier, he's like smiling, like almost laughing with glee because he's just so happy to see his wife happy for the first time in a while. And like them coming together is just like, it's just so beautiful because you like really feel their yearning and their passion and their deep love for each other. And you just think like it's implied, like it must have been a while since they've been able to get to that spot. And isn't it so nice that they got back to that spot together?
Oh, totally.
And
totally,
it's like, without that, like, I feel like, the relationship would lose so much. And I'm so happy they have that in there. It's like, it's so precious. And I love how they cut it. So it's like, they're still thinking about the sex after like they had it, you know, where they're just like
hanging
up their shirt and they're like, ooh, I was sexy today.
Yeah, I know. So that's why, like, it's very normal. And that's the way people are. You don't see that very often. You really don't. And I was just like, I was Steven Soderbergh. I keep going back because I just saw it, all these extras, but they were really illuminating. He talked about, he's like, I've taken so much from Nicholas Roeg. I'm surprised he hasn't hauled me into court. And he said, like, there's the part I haven't seen in years, but in Out of Sight, which is, really enjoyable. There's the scene, like three scenes in a row with George Clooney, Jennifer Lopez, like they're in an elevator and then they go up to the hotel room and then and his dialogue in each part. And he was looking at the script before shooting. He's like, you know, this is a little tea. We show them talking here. And then they're in the bedroom or the hotel room talking and whatever. And he said, he decided to cut it up very similarly, you know, talking before, after they make love, blah, 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 to Don't Look Now, specifically that scene. And people afterwards were like, oh, that's a great, maybe the best sequence in the movie, you know, in Out of Sight. And he was like, well, that's a total ripoff.
I love that.
You got to like Soderbergh for that. I mean, he's a great director, but you got to like him for that alone, you know.
One of the things that comes up a lot in this kind of horror is the grief-stricken child losing horror, is that the people move to a new place. And that happens and Don't Look Now. It also happens in your book, Scott. And Cass, it happens in your book as well, kind of the reverse, with a child who loses the parent goes somewhere new. And I'm curious, why do you all think we keep seeing this, like, you lose someone, you go somewhere new in the movie, to a new strange place or in the story? What do you think works about it so well that we keep coming back to it?
Oh, that's a good question. I never really thought of that. I don't know. I guess that's a real, maybe it's sort of, you know, I haven't thought of it much, but maybe it's sort of kind of like represents sort of like, you can't stay, you, I guess psychologically you could not stay in this. That would be true either way. A child's worst fear presumably would be losing their parents or a parent, yeah. Right? And vice versa. And I think either way, there's no way that the person, the child or the adult, the parent, could stay in that same psychological place. If they're going to survive psychologically, if not, you know, physically, they have to do something. They're going to have to adapt or change in some way. And I guess if you're writing a story or a novel, whatever, about it, you would explore that psychologically, but also like having someone move through space from, like, in a Screaming Child, that in my book, anyway, in the Screaming Child. That kind of is both, could be interesting as a story, you know, there's a little adventure and suspense in there, but also it represents like a psychological journey. That's the only way a person could heal to whatever extent they're going to heal and continue on in life after something that terrible happens. I mean, what do you think, Cass? That would be probably my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, similar, I feel like it's something that I was like, oh, that wasn't intentional, but I guess like kind of same vibes. I think it's just one of those things where it's like, I think place holds a lot of memory and a lot of patterns for people. And I do like that idea in stories that, like, I think this is why, like, I love ghost stories. I love haunted house stories. I love the idea that, like, who you are in a certain physical space is like, it's like, that's like a real thing. Like the way you are when you go into a library, like, you're a different version of yourself than when you, like, go to a bar or like go to church or wherever you're going. Like, it brings out different aspects of you just based on like, just your history with that space, the way you're supposed to act in that space, the people you've been in that space with. So I feel like moving away from those spaces just gives characters, I think, just more room to explore other selves, I think, you know, and just take some space away from the versions of themselves they knew. And I think it's kind of like, again, like with both of these movies, maybe it's like the illusion of control. Like, you're like, I'm doing this. And like, you can't really control grief. You can't really control things that have happened to you. You can't control like mortality, but like, yeah, like going on an adventure, going to a new space, it feels like it's something that is tangible, maybe, and a bit more real. So yeah, I feel like, I don't know. It's like, that's why we go on vacations, I guess.
Yeah, no, it's part of the same system. Right? Vacation, right. I think it is part of the same, you know, that's the temporary escape, you know, when you, right, exactly. But everyone has that feeling, at least when you come back from vacation, if it's a fairly long vacation or you went someplace yeah. very different, doesn't have to, you come back and you expect things at home to be a little, everyone's exactly the same. I mean, why wouldn't they be? and you're a little disappointed. You just went to India, right? You
say, you know, yeah, like, yeah. I was in India for 2 weeks, and exactly what you were saying. You come back, and everything is exactly the same. You feel different for a little bit.
For a little bit, at least.
Like, and then, like the cast was saying, kind of like the place, the context, the people, all kind of. Bully is the wrong word, but they kind of shape you back into who you were before.
I know, disappointingly, you're like, oh boy, here we go. I know. But no, I think that's, and this would be a more, and like the parent losing a child or child losing, that would be a much more extreme version, obviously. But I think, you know, I guess it starts with the story, but you know, this too, Don't Look Now, is definitely in that sort of like little subgenre of different kinds of stories, novels, books, movies, whatever. Not all horror, where they use Venice, because Venice, the ultimate tourist city. Have you been to Venice or?
No, have you been to Venice?
No, I have, yeah, many years ago. It's no matter how many tourists, when you think of Venice, you think of tourists. So it's one place where you're not upset, in my opinion, to see, like, it's, you know, it's beautiful. It's like a dream city. It really is. I mean, you see a million movies and stuff, when you go, it's really a dream city. And it is true. Like, I went many years ago, and I went twice with a girlfriend at the time, and we were walking around. Right? And then I was still there about a month or two later, kind of wandering around by myself. And I, after the summer ended, and I was going off to these little, and it's completely different. It is much emptier. He really, like, there are a few, I guess, like going back to death in Venice, but The Comfort of Strangers, the Paul Schrader film, it can be very creepy. And he captures that because it's like this maze and you walk down one place and you don't know where you're going, and there are no cars, which is totally unlike any other city anywhere. So the sounds are different. You know, you hear televisions playing through an open window. I mean, you hear all these, everything's different when there are no cars around in a city. It's not even in the country. And this movie, as well as any, and there are a few, you know, minds that aspect of Venice being a place that's beautiful, but unearthly, you know, where you're like trapped in the labyrinth of a mind, sort of, even though it's beautiful. And he captures that beautifully. I mean, Nicholas Roeg's always great, like walkabout. He's in the Australian outback. He's one of the masters at capturing like an atmosphere from a locale. But he does it, I mean, better, as well as any movie I've ever for Venice. In this, you know, I think. And he was saying like he would take things on the fly as they came, like adapt this. One of the scenes in the church, in one of the churches where Julie Christie, Laura, and Donald Sutherland's character are talking, and they had some scripted dialogue. They were going to talk about something that's kind of related to the theme. And he said something like, "This is boring," in off script. I mean, just like as they were standing around waiting to shoot. And Julie Christie said, no, I think it's interesting. And Nicholas Roeg said, that's more interesting than what we have in the script. And that's what they say in that scene. He says something like, and she's like, no, I think it's interesting. And then she starts saying why and stuff. And he said, these are what the real people, this is what they thought. And it seems like it jives with their characters anyway. And he went with it. He just went with it. He filmed it. And I get the sense, like, you could just see probably went to Venice with some plans, and then he just let his eye and his camera capture what would work and then edit it. And it's just, you know, you feel like you're there, kind of wandering around with them.
Yeah, it was a crazy amount of improvisation between Sutherland and Christie. It was also surprising to learn that they met on set the first day they were filming. They had to do the sex scene. That was the first time they'd met. So it's crazy to think they had such... Oh. Good God. Chemistry in all these other scenes. They really brought that like feeling to life.
They do. That's amazing. If that was their first. Yeah, it is. It really is. No, they had a great, they really did have a great chemistry. You know, you want, it's like sometimes you say like there's chemistry that's so good sometimes, like it's too bad these people never got to work again. You know, like in old Hollywood, it's like Hepburn Tracy, they work. Let's do another one. Okay, let's do another one.
But speaking of sex, what does Heather orgasming during the seance scene add or take away from the film? I'm curious, what's the relationship between like sex and the other world or the other side?
That's such a weird scene.
So weird. I was just like, why? I don't think I liked it. So I was just like, why is she massaging her breasts right now? I couldn't. It felt so odd. But I don't know. Like maybe it's just like the play in like Le Petit Mort, like the little death, like the
Maybe. Yeah. It could be something like, I don't, you're right.
Imagine directing that scene. Like imagine directing that scene and like, okay, and here's what you're going to do. Or the actor just does it and you just don't know how to interrupt them. You're like, well, it's in the cut now. Awesome. You only have so much film.
the orgasm in the actual sex scene is very quiet and real to earth. And the orgasm in the seance is very loud and porny, like very fake.
It is very movie-ish and porny. Yeah. You could say porny. No, I agree. I don't know. I mean, it is the fact that he's kind of like looking in or trying to look in. And then that person, the Italian guy in the building who lives there, one of the tenants comes out and it's sort of like he's a peeping Tom, you know, when he's looking in at a seance. That was funny. You know, it's kind of these, all these miscommunications, you know, but you're right. I don't know. Is that the little death or the constant connection between, you know, love, sex and death, Eros and Thanatos? I don't know. I never thought of that. There are a couple of scenes with those sisters, like when they cut to them just sort of laughing.
Yeah.
I've never been able to figure out, and it makes it seem like they're sort of like not all that they're not as sincere as they appear to be to Laura. You know, when you see them laughing like that, kind of cackling, and you're like, are they just screwing around with Laura? I mean, you're not sure. You're really not sure.
It feels like the ending has like an answer to whether they're screwing around with her or not. It seems like movie seems to be saying no, but that cackling scene never gets explained at all.
It doesn't get explained at all. No, right. If I had to guess, I'd say they were more sincere because mainly a lot of what they said was accurate. Like she said, like he's the one who's got it and stuff. So there's some sincerity for sure. Yeah. But no, that's the thing. They just sort of leave that kind of cackling there. We don't know what they're laughing about. But I kind of like, often in movies where not everything's explained, most movies overexplain. You know, then there are some movies that are just confusing and you just got the sense like they didn't really, they weren't clear in their own mind. I don't get that sense with Don't Look Now. There are things that are not explained, like David Lynch does that, where I know it doesn't bother me. I was like, he seems to know the key, even if we don't know the key, if there isn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I agree with you. I don't feel like it's like a bug that we don't get it explained. I think it's definitely the design. One other thing you mentioned that I wanted to circle back to, the scene where he's a peeping Tom is so great, because later on in the movie, he goes looking for them and he can't find them. When he finds them again, they say they moved because they were prowlers.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's
so right. He was the prowler.
I guess he was the prowler. That's right.
Very intricately woven film. Very good
stuff. It really is. You know, also, like, because it's so much about vision, seeing, not seeing, it's also like it becomes clear, like, how much of it is about just oral, you know, people, miscommunication. People constantly are saying, "What? What did you say? I didn't hear you." Then the Italian and English, obviously, there are people, there's a miss, like when he's with the police chief, the police inspector. Yeah, so you have that aspect. But like when they get the call from England about their other child, their son at school is supposed to be sick, and Laura's talking on the, Laura says she's going to go back. That phone connection seems to be terrible. Then he talks to Laura when she's in it. So there's a lot of that also, which, is not highlighted as much as the visual stuff where people say something and someone else is like, "What? I didn't hear you. What was that? What did you mean?" It's so, everyone's working across. It's very fragmented and everyone's working like the cross purposes. Maybe that's one reason it holds up so well, because that's sort of like modern life in a way. It really is. Huh? What? What did you mean? What was that text? Were you being sarcastic? What are you talking? Don't try to make a sarcastic joke, when you message me. It doesn't work, whatever. It really, that whole aspect seemed like completely contemporary to me, where no one really understands what anyone else is saying or doesn't listen. They either don't listen or they don't hear, one or the other.
Yeah, and there's something very infantilizing. Because I was just in India for 2 weeks that we talked about a minute or two ago, of not being able to speak the language and not being able to do things for yourself because you're in this new place.
Yeah.
Some fun trivia. Don't Look Now was often paired with The Wicker Man for double bills when they came out in the same year.
Two great films. Totally unlike each other, though. Although, they're both Stranger in a Strange Land, I guess, kind of films in a way. So, yeah.
Very bleak endings.
And very, main character. So, oh, my goodness. You mentioned a bar before. I would go straight to a bar after seeing those two films, if I had to.
Another little trivia from the same Criterion interviews you were talking about. They took out all the red from the sets and costumes to make the red of the little girl's slicker or the murderer's slicker really pop when you saw it.
Yeah. No, that was brilliant. That really was. Yeah.
And I love the red detail about, I think they changed, because I think in the story, the mother is supposed to be wearing like a red jacket or something. But like in the film, she has those like red pleather like looking boots.
Right.
The film, and I just like that she's still kind of, it kind of looks like visually she's carrying a little bit of the grief with her. Like, I think that was smart and very cool.
That was cool. Yeah. No, the red really, really, really sticks. I think it was Nicholas Roeg. He was talking about some painting from the 1600s, 1700s that's all in brown. And there's one tiny little speck of red in the painting, which is a woman's exposed nipple. Very small. And I forgot why. Somebody wanted to like cover it or something. I forgot the whole detail, but they sort of browned it over and it like completely obliterated, changed the painting. He said it was this one little speck of red. And, that kind of gave him this idea of like, if you bleach out everything out, take red out of it, virtually everything, it's really going to pop, which it does. Where if you just use it sparingly, like one of the scene, like that scene where they pull the body out of the canal, one of the victims of the killer, and you sort of see the camera pan over and you see like two little kids there and they're both wearing red or red scars. It's very, very used sparingly, but when it does, even subliminally, there it's linked to a death being pulled out of the water, just like their daughter in the first scene. Mm-hmm. And he does all of this visually. I mean, the story is like, if you were to watch that without sound, let's say you just had like some sort of music, I think you'd still get a lot of the feeling because it's really a visual film, you know, visually told movie. And that's maybe that's one reason it works so well. It really does. You understand it subliminally, even if at times, even if you're not grasping every detail of what's, you know, going on.
Another little trivia. Daphne du Maurier, the author, loved this film and hated The Birds.
She did not like that. I know. That's a famous.
Like The Birds, yeah.
I know. The Birds, the movie is very different than the story because the story is great, but it's more like Night of the Living Dead, the story. It's like trapped in one little farmhouse and these crazy birds. Well, I'm sure Hitchcock didn't mind too much, but, you know, yeah. I like the Birds. I mean, I love The Birds, the movie. I liked it. The story was great and the movie was great. Yeah. But it's nothing like her story. Maybe that's why. You know how authors are. They're so picky and sensitive and thin-skinned. Be glad Hitchcock's doing your movie. Are you kidding me? What are you? Yeah.
Do y'all have anything else you want to talk about in regards to Don't Look Now?
I don't know. I just would, you know, if anyone hasn't seen it, really recommend, you know, that it's just one of the great, it's one of the great horror films. It's one of the great, you know, Venice movies. And also, like, sort of what we're getting back a little bit to what we were saying, one of the great movies about a marriage that focuses on a marriage. And one of the great movies about people from one place who are in another place and trying to adapt to that place. In this case, it's Venice. And all the things they're trying to go through as they, you know, the city is like a mirror, you know, sort of reflects their mind in a kind of way. You know, they sort of it's the character in itself, the city in the story, I think, of the city of Venice.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so really, just a great, and it's holds up. You know, it was made in 1974. This is 50 years later now. Wow, and it really, really, kind of a time. It holds up completely. It's not. Did you find anything dated? I really didn't find anything dated in it, particularly.
The cutting was like way ahead of its time. Like it felt more modern than, like, I'm sure back then. Like I always think about when people talk about Bonnie and Clyde and how that was like a big deal for American cinema goers because they were just like, wait, it's not linear. Like and there's messes with like POV in a way that like was very French and like Americans just didn't really do it until then that much. But I feel like this is another one of those films where like in a way it kind of is and I know this is like what Nicholas Roeg was like going for. It like feels like it's the past, present, and future all at the same time. And like it's so incredible that I got away with doing that.
That's a good point that you made because they were mentioning, I think Soderbergh was talking about that too, just how rarely, even nowadays, I mean, that Nicholas Roeg was ahead of his time, but you know, he basically was talking about, like, you know, in the wake of World War II, the nuclear bomb and everything. And that's how fragmented modern life is. And it is more like that's more like how the mind works, especially now where you live at different time periods as you go through your day. Right. There's a period where you could be just sitting at your desk or whatever, and you're thinking about something from childhood. And in that moment, you're kind of living 30 years ago. And then what am I going to do for dinner? And then you're doing what you're doing at that moment. And that's kind of how the mind works. And very few films ever attempt something like that. And this really does, I think you're absolutely right. It's sort of like captures the past, those characters' past, presence, and futures all throughout. And that's so unusual. And it still makes, maybe that's one reason it hasn't dated, because it's very few people even try something like that in any genre in a movie. It must have been really something when it came out.
Right. I would love to have been a fly on the wall back then.
Yeah. What the hell? No, it got mixed. You know, I got some good equipment, but I'm sure a lot of people were very puzzled. It really was ahead of its, the editing and some very, very much ahead of its time.
What about you, Ryan? Any final thoughts on Don't Look Now?
It's one of my favorites. I did make the mistake of watching it with my wife at an airport. We had like a 3-hour delay. Like we were talking about the cuts before, the majority was just like people would look and it'd be like a regular movie. And there's a 15-minute sex scene, which is not something I wanted to watch on an airport bench in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But I mean, one of my favorite movies. I love movies where people just walk around grieving and then something horrible happens, and that's the movie. That genre really connects with me for whatever reason.
Oh, man. Well, are you ready to talk in 1997's Cure?
Sure. Absolutely.
So, written and directed by Kiyoshi Kurosawa, Kira tells a story of a detective named Kenichi Takabi who becomes slowly obsessed with a string of seemingly disconnected murders who have one thing in common, a mysterious X marked across their victims' throats. Dun, dun, dun. So, this was released in the States officially in 2001. So, it was right at the start, really, of the J-horror like explosion after Ryu came to the States in 1998. Has had a lot of fanfare around this. I don't necessarily think it's his best film. I still am fascinated with it. And this is one of those films I just saw it for the first time for this podcast. And I definitely need to rewatch it because I feel like what it does really well is like its central mystery is it really pushes you through for like the first half. But then once you kind of have a part of that mystery solved, then it becomes this like hyper intense, like character focused story. And then it makes you want to rewatch everything you just saw to be like, wait a second. So I've really enjoyed it. I'm definitely gonna watch it again, but I'd love to hear what both of you thought. If it was your first time watching it, if you watched it before, if you really liked it or not.
I did see it when it came out in the theaters, and there was like a bit of a, you're right, it was around just at the beginning of the J-horror boom. And I think, I'm in New York. I think they had like a Kiyoshi Kurosawa sort of like little festival, and he was totally
So
new to me.
rad.
I mean, I didn't know who he is, never had, but New York is good for that usually, still pretty good for that. And so they showed some of his early, so I saw like three or four. Charisma, the one about the toxic tree, that's a re that he made one about this, that's a really weird, I that's one I'd like to see again. It's probably it's like an environmental horror. It was probably another one, probably way ahead of its time, actually. So I saw a bunch of them, and this was one. I just watched it again last night. I agree. I mean, the build up is absolutely fantastic, and I still love the whole movie very much. But and it's hard to resolve, that kind of. I think it does it probably as well as it, because it's either going to come down on. Here's the example, because this is more like what we were talking about. Is it going to be supernatural or is it going to be rational? And this is sort of kind of leaves it open ended, would you say, in the terms of the solution is more of a, it ties in thematically to healing and people who are sick and mentally ill and under stress. But yeah, it kind of, it's hard. I think he resolves it pretty well. It's not quite my, I think Pulse probably is still my favorite of his films. Yeah, that's a really creepy movie. The detective, the main character, the actor, he really carries, and the guy who's sort of the villain, this who has apparently like these hypnotic, but he was great. I mean, seeing it again, like, where did they get this guy? His body language, and he's always like, he just doesn't care. He was really good. He was also very good.
I'm
What'd
with
you think, Ryan?
Scott. I'm with Scott on almost all of that. I think Pulse is Kurosawa's best movie, but I think Cure is also excellent. I agree, it kind of like threads the line between supernatural and naturalness explanation. And I think the ending, which I guess we'll go into spoiler territory now, is so great when the waitress picks up the knife, because we never get an answer to like, is she taking that over to the wash bin? Is she about to cut an X into someone's neck? And the detective is now the mesmerist. And I think that leaving that kind of open-ended, for my reading, it's that she's about to cut the X in someone's neck, but I don't think there's ever like a solid definitive answer. And I think that works so well. And it's part of the reason the movie just sticks in your head. You just want to think about it and think about it and watch it again.
Yeah, no, I agree. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I watched it last night, and when the credits ended, I went back about 3 minutes again to watch that very last scene. Like, wait a minute, because I'd forgotten it. It's sort of long. I don't remember how. What is she going to do? There's no answer. But I watched it again right away. I rewound it because for exactly what you're saying. That is a terrific opening, because maybe if there's a cure, maybe the disease was passed on to the detective. You're right. You just don't know. So that is a very good open-ended. And there's a shot too at the very end where you see into the mental hospital, and the woman turns around and sees that. That's not really explained either, but you get the sense that this miasma, whatever it is still floating around, right? It hasn't been put to rest with the death of the mesmerist. It's still out there.
And I think I love that what you said about like the disease. I feel like as I was watching it, obviously it's called Cure. So like throughout this, I was trying to see like, and also knowing Pulse and watching Pulse a bunch, I was like, well, what is this, like a virus? Is this something that is like passed between people? And the film doesn't really answer like what the sickness is, but I think there's just really fascinating, it's a little long, so sorry everybody, but there's this like quote that Kurosawa has that I just wanted to read aloud, that I was just like, I think I know what the disease is, but I would love to ask like what we think like the disease or the condition is. So the quote is, terror, I think, has many different levels. Changing into something different isn't that scary. Well, maybe a little bit. But I think what's scarier than that is not changing at all, becoming the same forever without any transformation whatsoever. I think that is truly terrifying. And if you add to that the condition in which you are the same forever without any alteration, I think the condition that most clearly embodies that is death itself. And so like, for me, I was like, wow, it's a wonderful quote. But I also feel like stagnation is like maybe the disease, like the people that are like not growing, not changing, not seeming like, because the main detective guy, very big spoiler, like the evil presence is obsessed with Takabi and says he's like amazing or so amazing. And I was like, what is so amazing about him? And I kept thinking about that. I'm like, what is it? And is it just because like he shows like drive and he's like an active participant in like everything, like is that what it is? Like the people that were just like, oh, I'm just the school teacher that killed his like wife, did he get like sick or he wasn't a good host because like he was like too passive or too just like complacent in his life? Like I was trying to tease out those ideas, so I would love to hear what either of you think about like what is the disease and or like what makes Takabi so amazing.
No, yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I got the sense, I guess it's sort of like stagnation, but he always says like, tell me about yourself. And the one with the when he talked towards the end, one of his later victims, the woman who was the doctor, she seems very calm and everything, because each time you see a killing, a little bit more is revealed as to what's going on, right? The first one, you just see someone kill somebody, no expert, you know, it's a good mystery that way. But then each time, then he enters the picture, then you see him talking, you see a little more. And one of the later ones, he's talking to the doctor and he makes it clear that she feels, he gets her to reveal that she kind of feels like what, stunted? She never really fulfilled what she really wanted to do. And he says like, well, you're just a woman, right? And she says, what do you mean? Isn't that what they said? You know, you're not doing bad for a woman. So he starts to eat at something that clearly has been eating at her. Yeah. That seems to be his uncanny ability, is like he gets to the depth of, he's like a cult leader or something. You know, he has an uncanny intuitiveness into what's eating at people. And then he said, like, there wasn't a part of you that always wanted to open somebody up, which was, I guess, you know, that was a good line, scary line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And she died. And the next thing you see her, she's, you know, literally peeling off somebody's face, you know, this perfectly calm doc. So I got the sense that the disease is something that repression in part, you know, sort of like with his wife too. When he finally, with the detective's wife, when the mesmerist is sort of like, you know, you feel put up, like how much anxiety and anger and frustration the detective feels. I got to do everything for her. She's a bird. Stuff he doesn't want to admit to himself. That's all repressed. So that's kind of, I get a sense that's at least part of it is what people are burying and what's eating, and they don't address it. And then when it comes out in a horrible, a homicidal way, not a good way.
Yeah, exactly that. I think he reveals people to themselves the parts that they don't want to see. So it's really self-knowledge is the disease.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're like, as animals, designed not to see the worst parts of ourselves because we couldn't live with it. A lot of us could not live with it. Mm-hmm. I think if Takabe has one thing, maybe it is self-knowledge, in that like he can see the seams in his life coming apart. And maybe that's why he's so resistant to being hypnotized. Or then again, maybe he's just lucky and his anger makes him knock away the lighter every time he's about to get hypnotized. And it's just an anger problem at the luckiest time possible.
Yeah. No, I think what was it? The mesmerist. I think he does recognize that Takabi sort of has an understanding of where the mesmerist is coming from. Maybe that's why he keeps saying the other people were completely oblivious and they were like his victims. But Takabi, you know, it has a little of that, like, but it doesn't do it badly because it gets overplayed sometimes. You know, the link between the killer and the detective, they're flip sides of the same coin. That's like a cliche in a lot of films. And it's so obvious. You're like, oh, brother, you know, they're hammering that again. Here, it sort of hints at that, but in a way that's works, I think. It's a because it's more of a psychological thing. They don't ever overly explain. But I think that's what he respects in Takabi, that Takabi has some, like you just said, some self-knowledge, you know, which maybe that's the thing that kind of saves him. Plus, he's aware now that the guy's a hypnotist. He doesn't want him to light that lighter. So he's like, you're not getting near that light. Yeah, but then his backup plan is the water, though. This guy was very sneaky. You know, you knock out my lighter, I'll hypnotize you with the water. But I think that was, and also like all of his victims, all of the killers, or people who have these very monotonous and repetitive jobs. The cop's job isn't so much monotonous. I mean, he has interesting things, but it is kind of repetitive, right? I mean, you're a cop, you every day wake up, crime. Yeah. There was a security guard, the school, even the doctor, they kind of have this monotonous, you don't ever see anyone with a very colorful life that he tries to get, or an unpredictable life. They are all very predictable lives, and that had to be an important aspect as to what he's getting at. You know, maybe that's a big thing too in Japanese culture, where it's very regulated. He's like an evil id, not id. It's not so much pleasure, but evil subconscious aspect of the mind that he brings out.
Yeah, I really like that. I really like that reading. Yeah, I'm just still thinking about Takabi. I feel like we kind of lightly touched on this earlier, but speaking of the real and the unreal in this movie, do we think that the shot when we see Takabi's wife murdered, it's like a quick flash, but through the perspective, we're seeing the nurse look back, and then we see the flash of like what looks like a corpse that's been dead for a while. Do we think that that nurse is imagining like killing like the wife because she like somehow got like infected by like Takabi, or like did Takabi somehow like kill his wife? Like, I know the fun of the film is it never answers that question, but I'm curious what your interpretation of it was when you saw that. Because I was like, I think he killed his wife, but how the hell did he get to his wife in the mental asylum?
You're right. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess it would have to be, you know, thinking of it rationally, so to speak, it would have to be one of those two things. Either he did it, or if I had to guess, I would say it's more like somehow something he passed along to the nurse. You know, but it's, you know, that's something it has, I guess, in common with Don't Look Now, is it doesn't bother us particularly, but it's something that's not explained that still adds resonance to the film instead of irritating you. Because I don't feel irritated, but I don't know. Yeah. A definitive answer to it, really.
Absolutely. I love the point you made about adding resonance, because that's absolutely what it does. Yeah. I read it as that he had killed her and he was using the murders to pin it on. Although he could have hypnotized the nurse. I don't have like a textual evidence to back up.
Oh no.
It was just my gut feeling as soon as I saw the wife dead and him sitting in the diner, I was like, oh, he killed her to be free. I'm putting that in quotes because I don't know how you can't ever be free in that situation. But
he feels it. He looks so much. He looks totally different. He looks like he's so much more relieved. Like the burden
at the very
is
end,
gone.
You mean.
He doesn't.
He's never looked that relaxed, and he smokes a cigarette there, looking really. You know, sometimes people smoke and they're, you know, they're all frazzled, you can tell. And he has that very calm, I don't smoke, but sometimes it's, you know, it looks cool to smoke. Like, oh, that looks very nice, but I'm not tempted, but you know what I mean. But he has that very, he's never looked so relaxed and relieved. So what if that's, thinking of it that way, that's kind of unsettling, because is he relieved because this whole thing is kind of behind him and he solved the case? Yeah. Or is he relieved because now he's kind of like okay with passing along, you know, this disease or whatever? But that's, you know, that's another thing. Like, thinking about it, between these two movies are both examples in a great way where the viewer is the detective. Like what you just said, Ryan, sort of reminded me, like you were sort of like, well, it's my gut. You know, you sound like a guy on Law and Order. I'm just going by my gut here, like the quintessential cop movie. We don't have any evidence. I have my gut, God damn it. I'm going to follow it. You know, that's the great cop line. But that's true. Like, it's sort of like both these movies, we are the detectives and we can solve a certain amount, but not everything. And that's when the movie works that way, I think it's like one of the best kind of movies, you know, where
absolutely,
you know, I mean, that's another one where David Lynch is like one of the masters, where finally it's like, I'm the detective. I'll solve some things I won't solve, but it doesn't really bother me that I don't get everything. And these two are perfect, great examples of that. You know, like we're hashing it out like it's a case and we're not sure, we have different interpretations of the, based on the evidence. We have different interpretations, but it's great for that. It really is.
Yeah, I absolutely love how, like, these two movies pair so well together because I mean, there's a lot of like shared tissue, but I like a lot that both feature people just making bad decisions. Like, I'm just like, why did he run out? Like, when Don't Look Now, why did he run after someone who's clearly like, it's not your child, you know what I mean? Like, it's not even if it's a child, it's not your child, and they're clearly playing, and you're running after them, like at dark, like you already were called a prowler, like right. You're not having a track record here, buddy. And then, like in this movie, like even after he kills, I'm blanking on his name,
Miami.
Even after he kills Miami, he hits like the record player and listens to like the Mesmerist's like old timey record, and whatever happens after that, whether or not he gets like possessed by the spirit or like the ex that Miami did possessed him or, you know, corrupted him or changed him or whatever, or he's just like a content detective now that his wife is dead and this case is closed, like we don't know, but like just the idea of like, well, why did you press play? Like, of all the things to do, of all the things that you actually had control over after all these uncontrollable things happened to you, why did you do that? And I feel like we don't know, but I feel like that's like interesting and obviously makes it a better story to do bad things in stories. But I'm just fascinated with both those characters' choices. Like, why did you do that? It's like the one thing you could have prevented. It's very like, don't go into that alleyway. Like, don't hit play. Why
right,
did
you right. No, you're right. But what's good about it is, you know, I never hadn't really thought of it that way. So many horror movies, and what's the class where, you know, don't go, you know, someone does something. Let's say it's like a not intent, like not a Scream type movie where that's part of the joke. Don't go in the house, don't go there, and they're going to go there. And you know, a lot of horror movies play with that now. But in so many stories, you see people make bad, stupid decisions. And it's really not, it bugs you in the audience because it's like, nobody would do that. I mean, that's not,
right.
But in these movies, it adds an element of realism to like fantastical premises. You know, it's that is how people, if it's well done, like that is how people are. Like you really, Donald Sutherland's character, you feel so fully, and the detective, the cop, you know them so well. The acting, of course, is great. They're both like ordinary people in a sense. And ordinary people, like you just said, make odd decisions or things based on irrational compulsion. My daughter died. Here's a little figure, a small figure in a red slicker. So it's not rational or smart. You're right. It's really not. The smartest is not smart. In a city you don't even know, they got lost earlier in the film walking around. To just follow, and there's a killer on the loose in Venice. He knows that. And yet I never was like, why, in the sense of like, that's dumb, don't do that, like in a bad right. horror movie. I never thought that ever. And the same with the detective, because people under stress and with all these things bubbling, that's exactly how people are. So maybe that's a key to these, another key to these kind of movies that helps them is, in a fantastical thing, you got to have people act very realistically, even if it's something that's irrational that they're doing, because that's what people aren't rational very often, especially when they're under pressure or not understanding what's going on around them. So that really helps both movies a lot.
Absolutely. And Takape also has this like track record where he's made a series of irrational decisions before. Like when they're looking for the first killer, he opens this random, I don't know, maintenance door. And he finds the killer naked inside. And that wasn't, who opens that door? There's no noise coming from it.
Right.
So he makes this series of rational decisions leading up, or irrational decisions leading up to playing the record. And they've all worked out for him. They've all led to him capturing Miami and killing him.
Right.
So
that's right.
He's just still following his intuition, which has rewarded him thus far. And it seems like now his luck runs out.
Now his luck runs. Maybe that's one reason that Naomi liked him. You know, said you're a man, because he could sense that he's someone who does have, he's tapped into his intuition.
Yeah,
and that maybe that was another aspect of kind of the attraction. You know, the respect that he seemed to have for him, whereas the other people totally were cut. The other victims were totally like cut off from what we see them to. From their intuition, their subconscious. You're right. It's partly what makes him a good detective. But now he's run into a killer who, that's his domain. That's the killer's domain. So, yeah. But that is a very, and I don't know, I can't think off the top of my head of like many movies where you see that kind of, where it's that involved in the characters doing something rational, irrational, kind of following their intuition, half believing what they see, not, and then, you know, it leads them into very dangerous waters, you know, and they pay for it in the end, you know, even the detective, I think, because he might have killed his wife. He seems to be carrying something. He does seem to be carrying something. The fact that it's not spelled out is partly what makes it even more powerful, right? It makes it even more creepy, really. But, you know, I'll beware next time I go to, you know, get some sushi or something that I don't.
I was surprised at the hypnosis being, I guess, the superpower of the film, for lack of better words, because it really is like the driving weapon is just like using people's minds against themselves. However, whether it's real or not, whether he's just like a master manipulator or he is actually like, you know, pushing people with like a genius level, like hypnosis. So I would love to know if the hypnosis parts of the film worked for you. And also, have you ever been hypnotized, and would you get hypnotized?
Well, no. that was one aspect where, you know, I remember seeing it the first time. I was basically like, you know, like you just did. It did, you know, once you realize that that's the trope. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, that is a kind of old Hollywood movies, you know, obviously had that a lot of times, and someone kills when they're under hypnosis. But they address that in the movie. You know, they do say, like, which from everything I've ever read about hypnosis, you can't change someone's moral nature and stuff. Mm-hmm. Unless you had, right, there's a little out there, unless the hypnotist was a genius, you know, something like that. I don't know what a genius, but no, I accepted it, because that's sort of, once you realize that's sort of the premise, you know, it's like if it's a vampire movie, the premise is there, it's a vampire, you know, it's a vampire. If it's a, right, if it's a werewolf, here it's not that supernatural, so to speak, but I didn't bother me. I mean, it's basically, it's going to be about hypnosis. They do address it realistically enough, in the sense like you can't change, but maybe this person has got that little extra and he uses the flame. So it didn't, once I realized that's the premise, I thought it developed it very well. It didn't really bother me. I've never been hypnotized. I'd be curious too, but I'm a little scared.
Apparently, yeah. First saw it. It was like, I was interested in getting hypnotized. And I was like, I bet you I'd be really confident that like I wouldn't get hypnotized. And then like a friend told me those are exactly the people that get hypnotized, the people that are overconfident. So he's like terrified of being hypnotized.
That's what I always thought. So now they can't hypnotize me. You know, it's not going to work. But I never put myself to the test. So I guess that says it all right there. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I have not been hypnotized. I don't think I would get hypnotized, but I'm worried. Like, it would either not work at all, or I'd go deep. There wouldn't be any in between. In regards to the film's hypnotism, it felt like, and I mean this complimentary, like an X-Men character was in the real world in Miami. But the tone won me over so fast. And like, there's all these little things Kurosawa was doing. Like the first murder takes place like very distant, and I think there's like, that's really the only murder where music is playing. It's like this like upbeat jazz, so it's very tonally clashing.
Yeah,
and it sets this like very dark tone for the film, and that wins me over. So by the time we get to hypnotism, I'm like totally in. So it doesn't matter, he could have given me any explanation.
Yeah, that's a good point, right?
Yeah. I think like you were saying earlier, Scott, like early Hollywood would have done something like this, would have been very hokey. And because of the tone in this, it never feels hokey at all. It's just, we have these people who are getting the X's on their throats cut, and they're by different killers. So we need something to link them. And you tell me it's a hypnotist, and I'm like, okay, I'm there.
Right.
With this tone and how far we are from the violence when it happens, it just feels so visceral to be that far away.
Yeah, no, that's pretty much how I felt too. And it was, you know, it followed, in that sense, it followed like the classic sort of narrative, where they gave you a little bit of a scientific explanation as a possibility, and they mentioned the real Franz Mesmer, the Austrian hypnotist from the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. So it sort of grounds it a little bit in reality and what hypnotism is. And then after that, you just sort of, but you're right, the low-key approach, and like in comparison to the hokey Hollywood old movie where the hypnotist has eyes that shine, you know, or gleam, yeah. Or they take out the watch and they start, you know, look us there. That again, that actor, the act, the way he played it, so, you know, he too was so understated. He was creepy, but he was so lackadaisical about everything. And that sort of sold it also. It wasn't the super genius mastermind hypnotist from the old days, like in the hokey way, and his voice. And you could just sort of see. And you also got the sense, not so much with the detective, even though a little bit at the end, you get the sense that people want to reveal. Because he says, tell me about yourself.
Yeah.
And that's another thing with people bottled up and they have no one to talk to, living like these kind of lonely, urban, you know, contemporary lives that everybody leads. And you're disconnected. And then suddenly someone's saying, tell me about you, you know. And that has to be part of the appeal. We don't know anything about him. And he doesn't, whether he really has amnesia or whatever, we learn a little bit about him as towards the end of the movie, his background. But people want to reveal something about themselves. That came across to me, I think.
Yeah, I love at the end of the movie, you just reminded me of it, when Takabi kills him. And in his final moments, he's like, do you remember everything? And he just smiles. He's like, I remember everything. And you're like, did you know everything this whole time? like what? And it's like whether or not he did, or whether or not being that close to death made him like get everything back memory wise. Like, again, we don't know.
We don't know. Yeah.
Another layer where you're just like, what?
He really has a sort of an Kurosawa. I don't know if elliptical is the right word. He's sort of subtle, a subtle way of bringing all this stuff out, but it's there. But it's the fact that it's not overstated. It really helps. And it's another one. I think you could watch this, you know, several times. And each time you're going to come away seeing something different and still be, you know, scratching your head in a good way about certain things. It's not something you're going to just, oh, I see it all. Right. It's not that kind of movie the way he does it.
There's like a really small detail that, like, at first I was like, I thought this was going in a different direction, but then it didn't. But only because I've seen Pulse. You know how like his, like, iconic effect in Pulse is when someone is, spoiler, if you haven't seen Pulse, this is a pretty big spoiler, but if they're like dead, they're almost always like all head to toe dressed in black. And they kind of do this thing where they're like, you could tell a figure is there, but it's almost like they meld into the wall and they're just like, they feel like a fixture, but they also kind of feel like smoke. Like it's that's how the dead people show up in Pulse, and they kind of like slink into the shadows. There's a scene where Takabi goes into Miyabi's jail cell, and he's just like in the corner of the room, and it's the same effect where he's like all dressed in black, and he almost looks kind of like smoke, and also is just like kind of a part of the wall, and then like steps forward a bit into the light. But there's that second where it's just like, from that point forward, he's like, I'm pretty sure only dressed in black after that point. So for a second, I was like, did he die? Like, I mean, I know, he died, but like, maybe a part of him died. But I just love seeing that small special effect that then obviously like a couple years later, 3 or so years later, when he made Pulse, gets used way, way, way more. But it's an interesting that he was already playing with something there. Whether or not he knew what it was, I thought it was cool to see.
You're right. What was that? Definitely. That was a really good. What was that painting that without the face?
Oh, yeah.
Remember when it was like at the farmhouse or something? And you saw it a couple of times in the film. I'm not really sure what that was. You know, the detective sort of sees this, you know, I don't know if that's sort of a self-portrait in a way of the killer, because he's like a blank slate. People read, you know, sort of read into him what they want. But that's also another thing where it's kind of not, it has some meaning and importance based on the way he looks at it, the detective. But again, I'm not quite, you know, you're not quite sure what it is, how it got there. Nothing like that is explained.
Yeah.
I thought it was the face of the original hypnotist.
Oh, right.
It was a very sparsely populated face.
Right, right. Yeah, because they mentioned they in the movie there is some footage, you know, supposedly this old footage from the end of the like 1898 or something, where you see the Japanese hypnotist who was a disciple of Mesmer hypnotizing this woman for hysteria or whatever they say, and the hypnotist's face is never shown in that what's supposed to be that footage, because it would have, you know, angered the authorities. They were kind of persona non grata. They were considered like occultists. So right, it could be him. It could have been that original sort of the Japanese hypnotist.
I was gonna say I like the blank slate part that you mentioned, because even there's like a flash, I think at some point, where you see the supposedly Mesmer's photo in a book, but like it's still a recreation. It's still like a drawing of his face. So we don't actually know what the guy looked like. And I loved your idea of like, it's sort of a face, but it's missing a lot of details, but that's all they'll get. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, I think when you have directors who really have confidence, you always can sense. I think a viewer can sense when you watch a movie that has these kind of storylines and doesn't necessarily explain explicitly every detail. As a viewer, you get a sense when the director, the filmmakers know what they're doing and don't know what they're doing. Like they didn't confuse just to confuse, or they didn't like lose control of their material. You just get a sense, like we're debating this or, you know, discussing this, like what was that? That they knew what they just sort of know what they're doing. It's done with authority, and you can interpret it this way. And it, I don't know, somehow that just comes across. You know, if you see a Nicholas Rogue or Kurosawa compared to whoever, you're like, I don't know, that was confused, jumbled, and just a mishmash. And you just get the, it's hard to pin down why, but you just know when someone seems to know what they're doing in terms of planting mysteries and questions. I mean, do you get that sense or?
Absolutely. I definitely get that sound.
Yeah.
I'm just nodding. But,
I guess he's still, I mean, Nicholas Rogue, he was an old man. He died 7 years, but Kurosawa's still going, still making movies, I think, right?
Yeah, I believe pretty so.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's, he had a run there. He really did have a great, run there. Yeah. But I mean, if you ever get a chance, I'm not sure where it's around. I'm sure it's on DVD or Blu-ray or some. This movie, I just saw it once. I got to see it. This movie, Charisma, with the same actor. I forgot his name. You know, the lead from Cure, the detective. And it's about this weird, poisonous kind of tree some people are trying to protect and other people are. Another one. It's full of enigmas.
Oh.
I saw it at same around the same time. So 96, that's a while ago. And yet, and I don't remember the details of the plot, but that's a great, but it still sort of resonates in my mind as this odd kind of film. That had a more of an environmental slant, for sure. And I'd love to see it now in light of like all the environmental catastrophes of today. I'd love to see this film again, but keep that one in mind. It's another one that's sort of ecological horror mixed with mystic, you know, sort of things. Charisma. The tree has a lot of charisma, so the title is sort of explains it. But and he's great as this kind of everyman. Even here, he's kind of like an everyman in this strange, you know, with all these strange mysteries. But he comes across as like a normal person, right? It's sort of an everyman, working guy. Here he's a cop. I forgot what he is in Charisma. It's something similar. He goes out to investigate this tree, and he runs into some weird people. But he's like your guide through the story. You know, you can relate to him. I think that's what happens in this movie also. But
it sounds great.
Yeah. No, it's really good.
It is not currently available online. That's what I was looking up on my phone.
Oh, you know.
Somewhere it was streaming.
But I don't know. Any other just like particular? These are two of the best examples, I guess, of movies that I think, too, one reason, like we were talking before about a lot of movies that are, or even stories, where you have that mystery, supernatural sort of thread, you know, line that's a thread, and they sometimes rely on a twist. Like Angel Heart would be one.
Angel
like
Heart's
that's like
good
the,
one.
That's a good one. And I assume a lot of people have seen it, but that's one where it's going one way, you know, it's in the hard-boiled detective realm. It's clearly that there are intimations of weird things going on, but it comes down very firmly on one side at the end, right? Very, very clearly. And it's better not to know that going in. You can still enjoy the movie after knowing that. It's a good movie. But these two movies, though, I think what makes them really strong is they don't have clear rat. It's not a movie that comes down one way or the other. Like, it seemed like a mystery, supernatural explanation. It seemed like there was all these supernatural doings, but it turned out it was rational. So it's one or the other, and you don't want to give the ending away because that takes away the enjoyment, at least the first time. Here, like we were saying, you know, spoiler this. I don't even knowing the spoilers. I mean, you know, to an extent, you're still going to enjoy the movie because the whole journey is so mysterious without a definitive resolution one way or the other. These two movies are rarities, I think, in that regard. There's no super twist at the, we thought it was a man, but it was a woman. I mean, there's nothing like that here. It's not The Crying Game. You know, it's nothing like that. And that's one thing I think that makes them hold up well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just reduce it to one or the other.
One thing I wanted to say about Cure, just because I love it and I want to point it out, the soundscape very much matches Takabe's emotional scape. And then we have these like long sections of pretty much silence followed with like just bursts of violence and music.
Mm.
And I think that all works super well. Like, I just feel like they really captured his interior landscape with the sound, which is something I don't think I've seen in very many films.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You're right. I didn't really think that. I think you're absolutely right. It has a stillness to it, which is sort of like his personality. And like you said, you know, I have to like Pulse. I remember a few of his films, like Pulse, where he uses like uses sort of discordant music or soundtrack effects that don't really match what you think you're going to hear based on what's going on. Like you said, like with the first murder in Cure. Yeah. And you hear this kind of jazzy music, you know, it's startling. And it's even more effective than like typical thriller music, you know, because it's really unexpected. It's very, very unexpected. But I think you're right. It's a very quiet movie. And he's a quiet person, but there's a lot kind of going on, you know, inside. But you're right, he uses sound really well to sort of mirror, reflect what's going on in his internal, you know, you're right, internal feelings.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I was reading an interview with Kurosawa, and he was talking about how he doesn't really like sound in his movies. Like, he will add it, but he just doesn't like when the music dictates, like, how someone should feel about a character or, like, what it means, like, what they're doing. Mm. And he really wanted the film to be, like, I think that his words was, like, there's a world before the events of the film and there's, like, a world after. And he likes keeping it very open in his work. And I just think that's such... just like such an interesting take. So I think it's true in horror, especially. There's so much scores. There's so many scores like tell us how to feel or what we're supposed to intuit, or like we know danger is coming because the music ruined it. And I feel like whenever I think of some of my favorite horror movies, it's when there's no sound. And then I get jump scare out of my like seat because I didn't expect it was coming because nothing was like cueing me in, and how like stillness can be really unsettling too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and he uses like the effects of like the natural, like the light, after you see that the lighter is something dangerous in the hands of, like when the lights, can I smoke a cigarette? And if, you know, lights the lighter, like that little spark kind of, you know, that can be kind of unsettling. Or the sound, which there's a number of those Japanese, like J-Hart. Well, I don't know what it is about bathtubs overflowing.
Yeah. And toilets overflowing. Yeah, water.
When I saw that again, I was like, oh no, here we go again. Water.
Did you ever see Dark Water?
Dark Water, you know, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh no. Well, no, I'm scared already. Let me go check my bathtub, make sure nothing's happening. But but it's very effective. Like once he sort of brings you into that, and you know, by the later parts of the film, every time you see water sort of overflowing a sink or something, that's more unsettling than like some dramatic music. Just that sound of the water tapping, you know, the tap running, or though the lighter goes off, or the flame sort of crackling. It's very effective, yeah, and much better, more effective and surprising than like, you know, dramatic music or something like that. Yeah, I remember Pulse had something probably kind of similar. It was very good with that in general. This sort of eeriness. It creates a real eerie effect, I think.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, they really had that. What was the other Spiral? Oh, I forgot who did Spiral. That was another one that was really Japanese. That was a really creepy and had this sort of these sound effects and stuff. But yeah, no, it's really effective. Well, so, you know, you're talking about like that kind of the use of sound. The scene in Don't Look Now in the church when the beam falls is another one where there is music in Don't Look Now. Pino Donaggio, you know, the De Palma collaborator for so many of his films, great, great, great composer. But remember in the scene where Donald Sutherland's up there on that platform or whatever, is really, in that scene, there's no music. You just hear the workmen and you hear, oh, give me this. And then you hear Italian in the background and no cue. That's a great scene. I mean, there's no cue anything dramatic is going to happen. You just see a guy up there and it's a little tense because he's on this platform. So anything, you know, you could fall, you know that. And you're sort of on edge because of the movie by that point has you, you know, tense, but no cue whatsoever that anything's going to happen. And you hear the natural, and then you see first the beam coming loose and there's that split second where then you see him or then the beam crashes through the glass. That's another great use of sound or natural sound, underplaying it, and really makes it more really scary, more effective than. And it's a shock when that thing comes down it through the glass. Much better than you know, you hear this music, much much more effective. Oh
my goodness, my husband hates the A24 like foghorn sound, which is like it's like in every movie. You're like, what is that? What?
Well, that reminds me, you mentioned Fokker, Donald Sutherland, you know, just going back to the sex scene, because, you know, did they really do it? Blah, blah, blah. Good acting. But he said, like, he was talking about doing the scenes. Like, first of all, when we shot that scene, he didn't say it was their first time together. So that was, but he said that there's a few of us. It was Nicholas Rogue, the cameraman, a small crew in the room. And they had a certain lens or something and some machine they're using. And he said, have you ever heard one of those machines? It goes like this. All right, Julie, all right, turn your head to the left. Cut. All right. Now, you know, grab her breast. All right, cut. All right, Julie, come. You can come now. You know, to sort of put the lie to there was anything actually going on there other than acting. Couldn't have had a less erotic, you know, sensual backdrop to that.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, man. Oh, do you have any other thoughts, Ryan, on Curse?
Cure.
I was thinking, I'm now thinking of Curse.
No worries. Listening to an interview with the actors. And it was independent interviews. Both lead actors described Kurosawa as kind of being a hypnotist in the way he drew their performances out of them.
Oh,
I just thought that was a cool description given the plot of the film.
It is. No, it really is. I know. I don't, you know, maybe I've seen him. I don't remember ever seeing it. I mean, maybe I have the killer. The lead, of course, the detective. He was a big star. He's a big star. But I don't remember ever seeing the hypnotist in other movies. And however they got it, he just had this sort of like creepy. It's another thing. Like I like villains. You know, villain is good of any kind. It could be any, you know, it's someone who's dramatic. But like Robert Mitchum in The Night of the Hunter is, you know, that's one style. And he's phenomenal, right? And that's a certain style and it's perfect. This is like the opposite end of the spectrum. And, you know, when you have a killer who can be that creepy or villain, so to speak, who's that understated and that low key, it's more unusual than the other way. And it gets to you. I mean, whatever Kurosawa had in mind, he got it from that actor, you know. I mean, I hope the actor came out of it at some point. He isn't carrying around that disease for his whole life. He was very good, though. Yeah, that's interesting they said that. Really is. Really, they were very convincing in that regard. And his wife, too. That's another thing I think that grounds it also is like, you know, you see him in his daily life and it makes him more than just like the obsessed cop. That's another, you know, like the obsessed cop on the case. He has no personal life or she has no personal life. It's just like, you know, the case, they go home and their apartment's a mess and you see that they're dysfunctional except when they're working. He has a lot of problems because his wife is ill, but it makes him very relatable, I think. You know, it makes him very, very, a character you can really, he's trying and he's doing his best. He goes to work. He's stressed out about his home life because his wife has some sort of, you know, emotional, mental illness. And it makes him very relatable. I think that's one thing that helps the film also.
Yeah. I love too how they depict without, like, they don't go into it too much or like sensationalize her mental illness too much. I think my favorite example of like, oh, she's not well. We don't need to know what or why, but when he goes home and he sees that dinner set out for himself, and he does kind of almost feel relieved, like, okay, she's having a good day, whatever is happening. And then he tips open the plate and it's just like an uncooked, like rare steak that she just,
I know.
And he's like, and he just like reaches that level. And you're like, wow, I really feel for you, man, because like your hopes got dashed so quickly.
I know. He comes home from a hard day of work and stuff. And that's, I mean, there's carpaccio, you know, very rare things. And there's this. This is a whole nother level. It's not going to. But yeah, no, I felt the same. I agree with you. It's like a moment of peace. I can eat my dinner and then, you know, and it's sad too, because obviously she has problems and it's, you know, so then he just throws the steak across the room. No, that was a good scene, but you really fell for him. And so I think after that's when he brought it to the hospital, right? That was the final, basically the final straw. Yeah. No, that was really, I was like, it was poignant because we're going to take a vacation and we'll go to Okinawa. There's one scene where he comes home and like you're mentioning their relationship, he comes home and she's not there and he gets at night after day at work and he goes out, he's trying to find her and he finds her nearby, like walking back to their house, to their apartment. And she went to buy toothbrushes or something because he had said like we need to take a vacation. Maybe we can go to Okinawa. And she says, you know, kind of plaintively, no, well, we may need, you know, when we go to Okinawa on vacation, we're going to need toothbrushes in case they don't have them in the hotel. Little details like that, you know, that's where Kurosawa layers it really well. It's not all about the horror and the creepiness, or maybe it, I mean, that's another horror that he has to deal with, but it really layers the film really well. It has a good texture in that sense. You know, it's a lot of things going on. Very rich.
Yeah. That's all I have for. I'm trying not to say curse again. I just keep trying not to say curse, and I want to say
Oh
curse.
yeah.
That's
I
really all
gotta
I
watch
have. Have you?
that.
Well, that was all I had on my end. Do you have any other thoughts, Ryan?
Not on Cure. We should talk about the Screaming Child, though.
Yeah. I would love to
Can you
talk
give our listeners
to
like the elevator pitch for the Screaming Child?
the elevator pitch. Okay. In brief, yeah. No. So, a mother who's, woman who's married, her child disappears, may have been murdered or kidnapped, may be dead or alive. She doesn't know. She lives in a city. It's an unnamed city. Goes out into sort of this valley to finish writing this book that she's been working on before her child disappeared, and she's put off, stopped writing for a while. But while she's there, trying to like just bury herself in work and finishing this book, which is about the book is about a woman explorer who had gone to this sort of woodland beyond the valley where she's writing, this kind of wilderness, weird wilderness area. When she's living there writing, she starts to hear at night, she thinks she hears the screams of a child from this woodland that she's also writing about the explorer. And she's convinced that that's her son. And she goes back to the city. She tells the cop. She tells her husband. No one believes her. She even records the scream. But to convince people that it's her son, like, it's kind of inexplicable. And she winds up going towards this wilderness to find out, like, what is going on and is that her son or not her son. So it's a bit of a mystery, bit horror. And it's about, I basically, it wasn't an easy book to write because I am a parent. And I once read Ramsay Campbell, the great British horror writer, say he does some of his best writing by writing about his worst fear. So guilty as charged, I guess. So I took it upon myself. So the child is about 12 in the book. He has a lot of traits that my own son had when he was. So I dedicated the book to him. I said, "You're still alive, so you have that over the main character, over one of the characters, if he's alive or dead." But so that's basically that's what it's, and it's written in the first person from a woman's point of view. That's the first book I ever wrote like that. But I felt I could do it. It was a challenge. I got to do this well. It's not easy. As a parent, I could relate, I thought, to a parent's loss is a parent's loss. And her marriage is kind of rocky. Everyone is acquainted with either themselves, other people. So I thought I could capture that. I mean, that's not a great thing to heart, so thing hard. And that's where it was. But getting her voice was obviously key, in terms of as a woman and as a woman grieving. I mean, I've never experienced that. So
Yeah.
that's what the story is.
A really good book. I enjoyed it a lot. And I'm curious, how come you decided to set it in an unnamed city versus an actual city?
It was, well, real fast. The original kernel of the story came from a dream many, many years, a long time ago. I thought about it for a long time, how to do it. But it was in the dream. I was sort of, as you are in dream, I was sort of myself and not myself. And I heard this scream. It was a valley, just like in this barren valley. And from these woods nearby, a scream. And it's like, that's a child scream. That was the dream. I woke up and I wrote it down, which I used to do more than I do now. And I thought about how to do it. And for years, one of the main problems was, should I set this in the real world, like New York City or a specific city, or in a kind of dreamlike world? And I couldn't figure out which way to go. And I finally decided it's better to make it a bit more dreamlike. It gives me a little more leeway with my imagination. And say, it's a city, it's a valley, and it's a woodland, timberland. And it just was easier, more like a dreamlike quality, and easier to use for my imagination. And there is one part in the story where there's a reference to a canal city, like the son goes with his mother on a vacation. That's clearly,
Yeah.
well, that's Venice, obviously, yeah, the canals, but it's never named. I mean, it's pretty obvious where that is. And there's another part where a very key scene takes place in an oasis. And that's a real place that I visited a long time ago in Egypt called Siwa. It's a fascinating place in the middle of the Egyptian desert, not far from the Libyan border. And it's an fascinating 5 hours from the Mediterranean Sea, straight into the desert. You're driving through sand, white sand, classic desert. And then suddenly this lush, unbelievably fertile thing strikes up. It's big. They say an oasis. It's like a series of interconnected oasis towns that go back to Greek times. Alexander the Great visited this oasis in Siwa because there was an oracle there. So, but I didn't name that either. I just sort of, but I used a lot of real experiences and then sort of real places and then sort of, you know, left them unnamed because I thought that just added a more dreamlike quality to the story. So hopefully that helped. I'm glad you liked it. You know, thanks.
Of course.
Yeah, and I would love to hear because I think parents losing their children is like a totally relatable fear. And it's because of that. I think it is in like a lot of like horror movies and in horror books. So like when you were writing this for yourself, did you have like any rules of things that you wanted to avoid not doing? Because you're like, in my opinion, these certain ways of expressing it are like too tropey or like been seen too, like too many times before, like any kind of like rules like that? Or do you just kind of went from like a more personal place, like, oh, how would this character react? How would I feel if this happened? And just kind of like threw the rule book like out the window.
Yeah, no more of that. I more went by like, how would I imagine myself feeling? How would I think? How would I react? Or I think character, myself, whatever the character would react. But, you know, I basically tried to make it, I read a few things, all fiction, or I mean, not all fiction, all no like textbook-y kind of thing. I read The Year of Magical Thinking. I mean, it's always good to read Joe Didion, you know, no matter what you're reading, you know, by her. A few things like that. But I thought the main thing I wanted to keep in mind was that someone even who's grieving, no matter what a person's going through, they intersperse it with not, you know, some moments of humor. It could be darker humor. They still take some pleasure in certain things. They still do other things. Like life goes on. And I find sometimes in these stories, you know, with these things, it's hard to, I guess, to convey, but sometimes it's almost too much grief, you know, I said not too much grief, but they'll dwell just on like the horrible aspects. It's horrible enough. I mean, that goes, but I find like that's not how it's more effective as fiction, as a story. In general, it's, you know, people react, people all in very different ways. And I felt also strongly that there's the last thing that she did before she's in the story, in the book, that she does before she said her child disappears when he goes to his music lesson, his weekly music lesson, and he doesn't come back. She was mad at him because he had a stain on his shirt. You know, it's like a very mundane thing. Like he wouldn't change it, which I've had that argument. And I used to have that argument with my mother, you know, that kind of thing. Something very realistic and mundane and prosaic. I tried to keep that in mind also, because mixed with the horror of the grief, life's full of these mundane, prosaic details. And she's very upset that the last thing she ever said to him was like, how could you wear a shirt like that? You know, to your music, like, oh, Ma, shut up. You know, you're being an annoyance. Just leave me alone. The music teacher doesn't care. So keep the focus, like, very small detailed in that sort of sense, not try to make some big statement about, you know, and just convey it through what that character would feel. That was basically my guiding. One thing that was hard, though, was, and the next book is going to be totally different, was, you know, usually, I mean, hopefully that I have a lot of things in stories, books that are humorous, funny, even if it's a thriller or dark thriller, whatever, black humor. And this, sometimes I would come up with something and I would cut it out. I had to, you know, talk about repression. I had to, because it just wasn't appropriate. It would destroy, you know, for the story, for the character. So to stick to that tone throughout was, you know, that was a challenge. That was a challenge. But that was pretty much it. You know, that, no real rule book per se, but how would this character react with her personality? And her husband reacts differently. And what would the interplay be between her husband and herself? Yeah. You know, and there's a whole subplot, I won't give it over, where he seems to be reacting very strangely. He's doing something that's really like odd and kind of unsettling. And no one has said like that wasn't plausible, because people in grief, you know, you never know what they're going to be like. Some people are zombies, some people are histrionic. You never know. Some people start drinking, some people, whatever. You know, you just don't know. So
without giving it away, I found it fascinating how you had her escape and his escape foil each other so well.
Mm-hmm.
It felt much different, but very much the same too.
Right. Now that I thought, I mean, I'm glad that came across, because that was something I, you know, thought about, tried to get across. And there's a little bit of a mirror image of what they, you know, and how they react and what they're doing. And I guess there's a little bit of a classic, like he's the rationalist type, you know, and she's not so much not a rational, but she does have what she thinks is empirical, what might be real evidence, no definite evidence, but some lead that maybe their son's alive. And he's kind of, you know, dismissive, and he's supposed to be a lawyer. So that would probably jibe with someone who's kind of a rationalist. So there's a little bit of that, you know, that aspect. But no, that was something I was shooting for. Their reactions kind of, you know, mirror each other. And he tried to also be somewhat, even though it's not a good marriage at that point, it's not a great relationship, that she still, they are married. They had a kid together. And there were frictions before the son disappeared. But even when she's angry at him, or she still has moments where she thinks of her husband with you know, tenderness or sympathy. She knows that he's grieving, even if it's in a weird way. Because you know, people, you have this kind of, you're married to someone, you had a kid together. That's how people, I think, would react to each other. You know, he's being a jerk here. On the other hand, he's suffering too. You know, to make it as human as possible.
Yeah, I think so. You do a really great job too of capturing just like this. Speaking of small details, just like the ways that couples like sometimes are quietly arguing, you know, or like quietly upset with each other, like ordering the wrong drink, you know, like right. You clearly didn't listen to me, I asked for this thing, but here we go. Like there's this like kind of like lightly not totally sarcastic, but like speaking of like the woman's tone and like getting that down right, I think you did a really good job of getting that like particular just like kind of almost always lightly annoyed with your husband about other things, but like that felt very real, you know, like just being like, oh, this guy. And well, I think yeah, so natural. Yeah,
my own parents were married 50 some odd years. I've been married. So I thought I could get, you know, just put your ego aside and remember what your wife said at certain points to you, and put some version of that in. No, seriously, because when you put a little objectivity in, I can say, well, that was annoying, because couples do, yeah, they relate to each other, you know, very much in that way sometimes, even in, you know, very healthy marriages, obviously, the longer you're together, or just relationships, it doesn't have to be a marriage, you know, but yeah, no, I'm glad that came across, but I think that's always, even like with these films, but that's one thing I try. If the overarching thing in a case like this kind of story is something very serious and grave, loss of a child, which it is, it's got to be balanced out by, again, you know, like these sort of very realistic, specific, and most of the feedback on people have recognized that feels good, that it seems like at least I got that part, I got that across. So that seems to have worked. And that's a good, you know, I'm glad about that. But, and hopefully suspenseful and everything. So, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
it's very good at I think I was trying to explain last night, and I still can't really explain it well, but I think your prose is very direct in a way that like I think a lot of mysteries think that they're being like direct and intriguing, but a lot of the times it just comes off like purpley, you know, like, so I was trying to figure out like why I really like the writing in not The Curse, The Cure. I was trying to figure out like, oh, I'm so marveled by that script, because at the end of the day, like they're saying, there's not many lines in that movie. They say, "Who are you?" like 5,000 times, but I'm not bothered by it, just partially because of the delivery and the acting, but also because like every time it's asked, like in the context of the scene, it always like means something a little different. And I think that's like a hard thing to do that, like I think makes mysteries better, is to write like, it's not just clipped, but it's like you're getting a nugget of info at a time, and it feels like, I don't know, maybe it's something about like how it feels like you're piecing together a story because you're only seeing small bits that like at a time. And I feel like your sentences do that in a really like lovely way. So I did want to like compliment you there, because I was like, oh, I'm intrigued, but it's like the writing's direct, we're fast, we're going here. like not waiting for me to catch up. I'm like, okay.
No, thanks. Now that means, because now that's something I really try to do. I mean, you know, so many books are 400 pages, three, and they don't really need to be.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, one of my favorite writers is Jorge Luis Borges. We read him all the time going back to college. I took a Borges class, and ever since I've been hooked. And one of his essays, he said, you know, he also doesn't read, like, necessarily love these long novels. Why say in 400 pages what you can say in 8? Well, he can do that. Most people can't, aren't that good. I mean, of course, we understand that. You know, he's great. He's a genius as a hypnotist. You know, he's one of the greats. But I think the principle, though, is he's right. I mean, there's so many books are longer than they need to be. And for this one, I really, condense. And I think, too, that if you can, you know, pull it off halfway well, emotion is stronger when it's when the things are condensed. Like you sort of said, well, the prose can be purpley or just too expansive, and it sort of becomes too diffuse. You lose a great effect in a morass of words and paragraphs. It doesn't need to be that way. I think, you know, you chip away and say what, like, Joan Didion, I guess, would be a great, in all of her writing, using an example. It could be, I think it's much more powerful a story if it's done, the emotion's stronger when things are condensed. And I was like, another one of my favorite writers is Jean Rhys, woman who wrote, she wrote White Sargasso Sea, that's her man. And someone was writing about her saying, like, one of the things that makes her so great is the sort of combination of intense emotion, but great control in the sentences. And that balance, like if someone thinks something's very emotional and it's all over the page, sometimes it hurts the story. You know, and I think men like the hard boiled style, I write, read a lot of those kind of things. I like, but that's often like the male way to keep emotion at bay, you know, like Hemingway, for example, or Raymond Chandler, that kind of hard boiled. And I think these are generalities, but someone like Jean Rhys, Joan Didion, they're not hard boiled. They're just very economical and concise and condensed, but the emotion's there.
Yeah.
Whereas hard boil, it's more like all the emotions repressed in that kind of, I don't know, for lack of a better, macho way or male way, you know, so to speak. But the emotion's there, but that's, you know, something I think to shoot for, especially in a story like this, where there's a lot of emotion.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So, but no, thanks for that. I'm glad that sort of came across. Next book, though, will be hopefully much funnier.
Can you tell us anything about your next book? Are you still like I'm percolating? I can't say.
No, I'm just getting underway here. So I'm optimistic and everything's great so far.
Best book ever, Stage. Best book.
Everything's working. You know? No, this is going to be revolves around a kidnapping in New York City, real world, but it's also going to be a bit of a racial satire. So. And it's about this one's about a father, first person point of view, and he's doing something for kidnap. He gets involved, middle class guy, works for not a criminal, married kid, and he gets involved in a kidnapping scheme for a very good reason. But it also will be kind of like a sort of sad, satirical sort of racial satire. So that'll be the challenge there, especially in this day and age. To sort of, you know, go, but it'll be completely, I like to try to do something, you know, from within my own abilities, different with each book, with each story.
Cool.
So this one will be a complete change. And it's nice to get, I don't think I'll go back to a grieving parent anytime soon, because it's really.
It's a lot to be
my headspace. It's a lot. It's that headspace, yeah. It was worth it, but it's a lot, yeah, for sure. What is the one that Ryan was referring about? You are looking up, but.
It's called The Caretaker. Yes. Speaking of grief, it's about an ICU nurse who has like an estranged relationship with her mother, and then her mother dies. So she goes home to like take care of the house and stuff. And then the hospice bed is haunted.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Yeah. But there's also, hopefully, fingers crossed, I try to add in a lot of humor too. So like I have like a cousin character who's like her best buddy, and then an ex-girlfriend that pops up to try to keep it a bit light, because it gets pretty dark.
Yeah No, good, I'll look for it, but no, that's that's the way, that is the way life is. I think the best thriller, right, you know, the best thrill, the people who do these kind of the best, Hitchcock was an example, you know, leavening it with humor is always, you know, and it makes the suspenseful scary parts even better, you know, it really does. But that was the story of the screen. I wish I could remember my dreams as much as I used to. Great inspiration even if it takes years, you know, you get an image and you're like, wow, that was that was great.
Do you have any other questions for Scott, Ryan?
No, where can people find you online, Scott?
I just each week, I don't really have a website or anything. I mean, I don't want to say X now, because now I conflate that with murder. But although this guy was less bad than Elon Musk. So, you know, even with his killings, his X is probably less destructive than the other X, than Twitter X. I was thinking of that one. But no, I'm on Twitter. It's with my name is the handle. And pretty much every Tuesday, I write a little piece for a website called Do Some Damage. And it's a crime site, but it's basically now, I've been doing it for years, I can put any sort of musings about film or
oh, cool.
books and stuff pretty much every week or every other week. I'm on there. So, and I'm on Facebook and everything. But I don't have a, I probably should, but I don't have a website or anything like that. So, and the books, The Screaming Child, it's on Amazon. Or you can order it directly from Ghoulish Books, which is a nice way to do it. Give Max some direct, you know, support. Yeah. He's a great guy. He's a good guy. very, and a very hardworking guy.
Well, thank you for being a guest on our podcast, Scott. You've been lovely. I'm excited to read more about your writing about crime, because I feel like so intimidated to ever write about like crime or crime adjacent stuff, but I love reading it. So.
Yeah, I know. No, there was, you know, it's funny because there were certain things I can't imagine I will ever write like a private eye story. Yeah. Because I'm like, what am I going to write that any hasn't been done a zillion times? I love reading it, right? But that's one. I'm just going to sound like a bad, bad parody of someone good. I'm not even going to try. You know what I mean? So, no, I know what you mean as far as that goes. But no, thanks for having me. This has really been fun. It's really been a pleasure. It's been great to talk.
Thanks for coming on.